today's docket. And before we get started, we've got some housekeeping matters to address. And first of all, we would like to go through the exhibits that the parties have submitted to make sure that we are going to consider all the evidence that has been submitted to date. Let me get my list here. There we go. All right. The council can remain at the their tables there. I have the on August 10th of 09, in the realtor's motion for summary judgment, there was the realtor's affidavit.
Correct.
We also have records from the product commission.
Correct, Your Honor, it's marked as 2A.
And then you submitted copies of ORC 311.01.
Correct.
The 2000 version.
Marked as 5A.
And then 6B was Winninger's answer to the interrogatory number 15.
Correct.
Then you have Exhibit 8, the TTI catalog.
Yes.
8A, Winninger's diploma, 1987.
Correct.
8B is TTI's 1988-90 certificate of registration.
Yes.
8C is subpoenaed documents from the State Board of Career Colleges and Schools.
Correct.
9A is subpoenaed documents from Ohio Board of Regents.
Correct.
9C is copies of ORC 1713 dated April 14th, 1985, ORC 3332 dated October 31st, 1979, ORC 3332 November 1st, 1985.
You're correct.
10A exhibit is Winninger's answer to requested documents number 13.
Yes.
And that is, I think, 15A is Brown County Board of Elections, general election November 2008, primary election March 4th, 2008.
You're correct.
I guess that's the certified results of those. 16, exhibit 16 is Ohio Administrative Code.
Yes.
Exhibit 17 is chronological display of events.
Correct.
18 is Secretary of State records, consisting of Technician, Inc., Articles of Incorporation, original appointment of agent, subsequent appointment agent, AGA filings, change from TI to Phoenix Ed Systems, Inc., and resignation of agent.
Yes, sir.
And then we have on October 14th, 09, in Realtor's reply to respondents' memo in opposition to Realtor's motion for summary judgment, we have another affidavit by Realtor.
Correct.
And then on March 16th, 09, we have Winninger's motion to dismiss that was converted to a motion for summary judgment by this court containing the respondent's affidavit. All right, and then August 13th, 09, we have respondent's partial reply to Realtor's motion for summary judgment. It seeks to have all documents subpoenaed from Ohio Board of Regents introduced in the evidence. Affidavit of Jamie Callender, October 4th, 2002 letter from Shane DeGarmo stating in March 19th, 2004 email from DeGarmo. All right. August 20th, 09, in the brief of respondent in response to Realtor's motion for summary judgment, we have selected records from the Brown County Board of Elections, of which are memo on behalf of respondent, affidavit of Lee Spivak, May 19, 2008 letter by board to Varno. And then we have records submitted by the Ohio Attorney, from the Ohio Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent, that respondent completed Ohio Peace Officer Basic Training Program on May 24th, 1989, and also Ohio Board of Regents Affidavit Gym Calendar. And then on June 24th, 2010, we have the Affidavit of Lee Spivak. Now, in addition to that, both parties have recently filed not new exhibits or evidence, but evidence that original documents, sworn documents or certified documents, and previously submitted exhibits. So with that, Mr. Eagle, you are the realtor. Is there any other exhibits that you have submitted to the court that I have not mentioned?
Not that I remember.
Okay. And Mr. Rosenthal.
Judge, there is one that is attached to our notice of filing May 11th.
May 11th?
May 11th, 2011. Mr. Eagle has filed objections to this, and I understand this may be something that we'll have to discuss later.
All right. What does that exhibit consist of? What's that?
It consists of an email from Shane DeGarmo. It's the very last attachment to that memorandum.
And I think I mentioned that as...
There's also a letter from Shane DeGarmo, which is different from the email. And it was obtained pursuant to a subpoena duces paper by Mr. Varnow that was directed to the Ohio Board of Regents. But that's one of the items. I think the rest of that stuff we all have in the record. So
What's the filing that it's attached to?
The May 11th, 2011 argument. The court issued an order on April 15th asking, directing the parties to submit summary arguments and direct the court to where the evidence is found in the record.
Could you just read me that caption? It has a caption there. Could you just read me that caption?
Respondent Leninger's argument in support of summary judgment.
The email in question, is that dated March 19, 2004?
March 19, 2003, I believe.
2003. Okay. Because you submitted one that's dated March 19, 2004. All right.
Well, this one says Wednesday, March 19, 2003.
All right.
It's the very last document attached.
All right.
The balance of the documents, and the reason I attached them, I know there's an argument about 32 pages, was we were asked to direct you to where in the record you could find the evidence. I figured it was easier just to package it and try to sort through it.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
That's
it. Now, what we have before us today is each party has filed respective motions for summary judgment. In addition to that, over the course of this case, each party has filed at different times motion to strike the evidence. As I indicated previously, two recent filings by the parties. The realtor filed on June 6th notice of filing affidavit, and then just the other day, I don't have the document here, but respondent also filed exhibits that were in the sworn or certified format. So the court will consider those, listen to arguments here, as indicated in our notice to the parties. Each party will have 20 minutes in which to present their arguments on their respective motions for summary judgment or counter the opposing party's motion, and also as well as addressing, if you wish, why we should strike any of the evidence that the opposing party has submitted to this court for review in determining the issue of summary judgment. Since Mr. Barno, the realtor, has filed the writ of quo warranto. However, the first motion before us here was presented by the respondent, Mr. Winninger. So I believe that it would be appropriate for the respondent to proceed first, then have the realtor follow, and then we'll have respondent. I guess we have 5 minutes for rebuttal, followed by the realtor. So, Mr. Rosenhofer.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Eagle. I guess one of the things that we should address initially, too, as we were talking about the evidence, was we did file the original affidavit, so both Mr. Callender and Mr. Spivak yesterday, as opposed to copies.
That's it, yeah.
Which leads us to this. We did file a motion to strike, and I'll address that. As I read Evidence Rule 901, if it comes from a public record, absent somebody having some reason to believe that they raise that the document is not what the proponent claims to be, essentially public records are self-authenticating. So very practically, though we filed a motion to strike certain of these documents that Mr. Eagles gathered from the public record, they're public records, and we have no reason in reality to dispute that they are what they are and what the proponent sets them forth to be. Just as I would assume that there can be no realistic objection that the public records that we have obtained, including the copies of the affidavits of Mr. Callender and Mr. Spivak, are what they are. Duplicates are admissible as originals under 901. And then public records are also addressed under 901B7. So realistically, those aspects of the motions to strike we'll submit to Your Honor, but to the panel, but realistically, they're public records, and we really can't complain about them. I don't think anybody can. Mr. Eagle, for Mr. Varnow, also filed a motion to overrule our late objection to summary judgment material. Again, most of this stuff is public record stuff, and I think that's as far as it goes under Evidence Rule 900. The May 16th filing on Mr. Varnow's behalf with regard to Winninger's argument and objection, I've addressed that previously, but your April 15th order directed two things. File a summary memo of some sort that addresses your position on summary judgment, and two, direct us to where in the evidence we're going to find the evidence that you feel supports your position. The argument was 7 pages. I attached the balance of the documents, which we believe to be admissible evidence. So I don't think there can be any real complaint about that. Now, that said, as the panel has indicated, the first briefs with regard to summary judgment were filed in August of 2009. We're just shy of 2 years from the time of those filings with their attached evidence. In that evidence then were the affidavits of Callender and Spivak. The court succinctly stated one of the issues in this case in its previous decision that's been remanded, and that is the whole issue of whether the sheriff met the educational requirements of the qualification statute. Mr. Callender's affidavit and Mr. Spivak's affidavit stand unrebutted, and they should dispose of that issue wholly. Now, why is that important? Well, here's why it's important. There have been 2 years I should back up. This battle, this confrontation in some fashion or form has been going on, in my experience, since 2000. When it first arose, the logical place to go to talk with somebody about the problem was the Board of Regents. We go to the Board of Regents, we talk to some people, we talk with then Representative Jamie Callender, a member of the Board of Regents, a lawyer, uniquely qualified to know the inner workings of the Board of Regents as a member of the board. I'll talk about the issue of whether it's layer or expert later. The lay opinions are admissible. We all know that. Experts have specialized knowledge. Lay opinions are routinely admitted in cases where matters of common experience, matters of specialized learning without becoming an expert. I'll venture a guess that every law clerk of this court can quote Civil Rule 56 as to the standard for summary judgment. It's something they've learned. They don't leave that at the door when they leave here, whether they ever practice law or not. So what and how you deal with calendars, affidavits, one thing. But where I'm going here is that for 2.5 years, Mr. Varnow has had the opportunity to present evidence in the form of an affidavit, a deposition, something more than what's been presented, and nothing has been presented. It stands unrebutted. Mr. Spivak's affidavit stands unrebutted. Those were people that were there at the time and place that this was all actively ongoing, and with the statute that you're going to have to look at and interpret in place. Mr. Spivak's still alive. He hasn't been deposed. So as to that particular issue, the evidence stands unrebutted. The only other real issue that we see here is this break in service argument. And the break in service argument breaks down to two or three things, but the most important of those things is that there's an allegation that the sheriff had some break in service because the day that he resigned from the Brown County Sheriff's Office, he knew he was going to run for sheriff. That's why he left. Your Honor, Judge Piper's seen this go on all too closely in the last 10 to 12 months. So he did the prudent thing. He left. He knew he couldn't have a break in service. So he immediately went to Ripley and became an officer there. Now, part of the public records that were gathered are some records from the village of Ripley. Importantly, the sheriff's deposition is quite clear because he was asked 3 different times and the citations in our memo, footnoted to our memo. He was asked 3 times whether he had a break in service. He said, I made it a point to go and be part of Ripley the same day. And the record was shown to the sheriff at that deposition, and he indicated that record's wrong. That ties back into Evidence Rule 901 because now you have testimony that refutes this record that they're going to talk about. Those appear to me to be the two big issues in this case. Did he have a proper educational qualification under the statute? We've satisfied that burden by affidavits, evidence under Rule 56E, and by testimony of Dwayne Wininger, and by the affidavit of Dwayne Wininger, and by the balance of this record that we've cited in our May 11th of 2011 filing. The break in service issue is also resolved by the deposition of Sheriff Wininger. Absent there are questions, I'll reserve the balance for rebuttal.
Okay. Right. You have 20 minutes on. how much time is left?
11 minutes.
All right. All right. You're more than welcome to use 11 minutes, but we're just reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
All right.
Your Honor,
Mr. Eagle.
You may please the court.
Mm-hmm.
And good to see Judge Hutzel and Judge Piper for the first time. Appreciate you having us here today. What we're, first of all, Your Honor, I would not want our discussions about the exhibits to appear that. We are not maintaining the objections we made previously. I'm going to argue those somewhat briefly, but we have briefed them and would defer to that. And specifically asked, Your Honor, I tried to summarize it in my March 9th, 2011 filing, which is the renewal of the objections, which summarized where they are in the record so you can look at them when the time comes. In addition to that, my March 29th, 2011 filing, which also addresses objections to the more recent material. And I'll talk about why I think there is no valid objection to the material that we filed and why there is a valid objection to much of the material that they have filed in just a few minutes. But I do want to start out with trying to impress upon the court the importance of really what we're talking about here today, and that is the integrity of the election laws. Because we are asserting, and we're not the first ones to have asserted it, that Mr. Wettinger is just simply not qualified to be a sheriff in this state. And there have been years and years of wrangling over that, and it is now in your hands, and this is the only time that it has ever been in anyone's hands that has authority to do something about it, and that is to enforce the election laws. What we've presented to you is official public records. That is not where someone says something and then puts it in a public record, but the public records themselves of acts and transactions, what TTI, his school, really was, what the Board of Regents really did, what his qualifications are, and what his OPATA, Ohio Police Officers Training Academy certificate, really is, what the Board of Elections really did in their official responsibilities. That's what our evidence is the official acts of public agencies. What their evidence is people who say things to support Mr. Wettinger, give opinions, say we looked at some letter from someone and therefore we think the law means this. They put that in a public record and then they say because it's in a public record, now it's admissible for all purposes, and it's just not. The point is the difference is the form of the document is not important. It's the content of it. And I would suggest that there's not one jurist in this court who has ever had someone swear they think the law means this, and you accept that as evidence or as some kind of fact. And that's what Mr. Spivak and Mr. Callender are doing. They're saying, we think the law means this because we had something to do with when it was written or when it was produced. And you're supposed to accept that over the law. And that's why what we have is different. It's the statutes. We're not asking you to believe my opinion of the statute. We're not asking you to believe Spivak or Callender's opinion of the statutes, but to read the statutes. And when you read the statutes and compare that with the official documentation of what really happened, there's no question that Mr. Wettinger is not qualified to be a sheriff in the state. And every minute that goes by that you let him is an unqualified person who's gotten around the election laws. And that's why it's important that this is in front of you and that we're going to get to the bottom of this one way or the other. And that's why there's a difference between public records that are the official public acts and documentation as opposed to someone swearing something to support someone they know, putting it in a public record, and then trying to get you to buy it as evidence. And it's different if it's an expert or lay opinion as to what time it is or how fast a car was going. They're telling you this is what the law means. And they want you to accept that as fact, and I don't think that you can. And I've argued that, and I've briefed it repeatedly, and I know the court will take that into consideration. So let's start with the merits of exactly what it is we're here to talk to you about. Let's start with the fact that the Supreme Court has said repeatedly that election laws are mandatory. They are to be strictly complied with. There is no room for substantial compliance. There is no room for liberal construction of the documents or the laws in order to let someone get by with little mistakes, little errors, and little deficiencies in their qualifications. My May 16th replay argument, page 2 and 3, cited the cases, including from the Ohio Supreme Court, saying so. Recently rejecting an argument from a sheriff. And why it is, it's just a funny, I guess, so much quo ronto litigation is about sheriffs. It is amazing because you don't see so many cases. They're always about sheriffs trying to get an office when they're not qualified. Why that is, I don't know, but it is. Most of the cases are like that. But if you look at the cases we cited, they specifically say one argument was made that a sheriff tried to say, well, I've had life experiences. And that's the same thing as educational qualifications, so just let me slide by with that. And a Board of Elections said that's fine with us. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not, because the election law, the statute doesn't allow for that, therefore it's not allowed, he's thrown out of office. That's how important it is that our elected officials meet to the letter exactly what the law says. Secondly, The applicable statute, which is 311.01B, says what sheriffs have to do. And if you miss one of those elements, it's like, we've done so much criminal work around here, it's like one element of the offense. If it fails on one element of the statute, they cannot be a sheriff. End of story. Three different reasons why Mr. Weninger is not qualified to be sheriff. Any one of them disqualifies him from the office. Any one of them. I think all three do. And I've cited the authorities that say any one of them is disqualifies the person. And that's my argument, my May 11th argument, page 6 for the citations. I'm not going to repeat them here during my argument. The first one is the educational requirement. And I'm continuously scratching my head trying to figure out how you can be asked to read a statute that says he has to have 2 years of post-secondary education at the school for 14 months. And he's supposed to have you say, well, that's close enough. The statute clearly says 2 years post-secondary education or the equivalent of semester hours or quarter hours. And this is all defined by statutes. There's no fudging room for what's 2 years. And there's no fudging room for what's quarter hours or what's semester hours. There's none whatsoever. His own testimony in his deposition at page 7. My argument on May 11th at page 10 to 11 explores this. He started school in August of 1986, got his diploma in October of 1987. That's 14 months, and he was required by law to have 2 years of post-secondary education. It's just not possible. By calendar or any other method. And that's what the law is, and that law has not changed. That's still the requirement to this very day. Now, even if you try to equate it in semesters, 4 semesters, I think, makes 2 years. I got a kid at Ohio State, so I'm pretty keen on that stuff. You can't get 4 semesters in 14 months. It's physically impossible. In his deposition, Your Honor, he even said that he went half the time, some of the time. Half the time he was going to school during those 4 months, 14 months, some of the time. That's page 7 of his deposition. So he has to tell you, and his friend Mr. Spivak has to tell you, and his friend Mr. Callender has to tell you, that 14 months is close enough to 2 years to squeeze by for an elected official who's the chief law enforcement officer of Brown County. It's close enough. It's not just the educational time. It's also he went to the wrong school. And this is also very plain in the statute that specifically says he has to have 2 years of post-secondary education from a school accredited by the Ohio Board of Regents. It doesn't say something like the Board of Regents or something comparable to the Board of Regents. It says the Board of Regents. And every piece of evidence that everyone has submitted here, which is the objective stuff from the Secretary of State, from the Board of Regents, from the State Board of Career Colleges or whatever, TTI, and the flesh out some of the facts, he went to school at this place called Technicron Technical Institute, where he got his diploma for whatever it was in robotics processing or something like that he got in 14 months. And the TTI was under the official control governing body in Ohio of the State Board of Career Colleges, not the Ohio Board of Regents. It never was, it never has been, it never could have been. One of the requirements, as I've cited in my brief, to even be qualified to be accredited by the Ohio Board of Regents is you have to be in existence for 10 years. And when Mr. Weninger went to school there, TTI had only existed for 9. Had only existed for 9. It could not possibly have been accredited by the Ohio Board of Regents, which is what the law required at the time he went to school and at the time he first ran for sheriff and at the first he got elected for sheriff in the year 2000. This is one of my bones to pick with this Callender and Spivak affidavit where they want to say, well, it's close enough and it was kind of like it and it was pretty close, this and that and the other. And I've cited the authorities that if the legislature leaves it out, they left it out on purpose. And it says Board of Regents. End of story. So not only did he not have the proper number of hours, he did not have go to the right school. It would be like us trying to apply to the Ohio Bar Exam when we didn't go to an accredited law school. Well, it's close. It's a law school. It's mail order from Tokyo or something, but it's a law school, so it should count. And you know good and well they would not let us do that. Well, that's what he's asking you to do, to say that because it was the State Board of Career Colleges, not the Ohio Board of Regents, that when the legislature said Ohio Board of Regents, they didn't really mean that. Just like they didn't really mean 2 years. 14 months is good enough. It's more important than that because even the educational credentials that he had at TTI could not possibly have been the equivalent of the Board of Regents. And the reason for that is, and I cited this in our memorandum, May 11th, a memorandum at page 10 and 11, the Board of Regents accredit schools. To get your degree, you have to have at least 90 quarter hours or at least 60 semester hours. But TTI's credentials under the State Board of Career Colleges says you can't have any more than 90 quarter hours or 60 semester hours to confer degrees. They're completely opposite of each other. So going to school at TTI to get his diploma for whatever it is just the opposite of what the statute said he had to have to be able to be sheriff. So he did not have the time in to be educated as a sheriff. He did not have the proper institution to be educated as a sheriff. There's a third reason why he's not qualified to be sheriff, and that there's no factual dispute about any of this, is that he had a break in service. And here's what the break in service means. Under the Ohio Administrative Code, it says officer, and by the way, the statute says you can't be sheriff unless you have a valid peace officer certificate. Everyone knows that. Mr. Weninger in his deposition admitted if he didn't have a valid peace officer certificate, he can't be a sheriff in the state of Ohio. One of the things that's required, one of the requirements of maintaining a valid peace officer certificate, if I can find my scribbles about that, it's Administrative Code 109:2-1-12, specifically subsection capital letter D, is if you no longer have a valid appointment as a law enforcement officer, in other words, you're off work in a valid appointment, for 1 year or less, your certificate is still good. There's like a grace period for when you're not working. If it's from 1 to 4 years, you have to go back to school for at least a year to get refresher courses to be a police peace officer. But if it's 4 years or more, the certificate is dead. It's you have to go back to the police academy, and that subsection of the Administrative Code, subsection F. You cannot act as a peace officer. You can't carry a gun. You can't perform the lawful duties of a police officer if you've not had a valid appointment. In other words, they don't want you laying out not being a police officer for 4 years and then come back and try to do it again. It's too important of a job. So a four-year break in service means your certificate is dead. You cannot be a peace officer. Now, when he became sheriff in 2000 with no proper educational qualifications, he had no valid appointment. And I don't want to sound like it's semantics or mixing words, but they want you to do is say that because he was pretending to be a sheriff without the educational qualifications, it's good enough. It's like that recent Supreme Court case where the sheriff tried to argue my life experience should meet the educational requirements, and the Supreme Court said no. He wants to say that his illegal position of sheriff should qualify as being in service. And I'm saying I don't know how a jurist can endorse that. Say if you can sneak into office illegally, holding that office long enough means you're qualified for it. It just can't be done, I don't think. So when he took office in the year 2000, he was no longer had a legal valid employment as a police officer because he was illegally holding the sheriff's position. 4 years later, his certificate expired. Now, if you look at Exhibit 2A, which is his documentation from Ripley, which if you'll also look in his deposition, he says was falsely notarized. Look at page 43 to 47 of Mr. Weninger's deposition, which is on file. He says there was a mistake made in his notarizing of his document. It was signed the wrong day or something like that. So, and if that's true, then he was never validly appointed to any office anywhere because it was a false notarization of a document. That was his own allegation. But he quit Ripley Police Department in December 1999 so he could become sheriff. I've cited to you an attorney general's opinion saying you can't be a municipal peace officer and a county sheriff at the same time. It's a conflict of interests. You can't do it. He couldn't do it either. So when he left the Ripley Police Department in December of 1999, he took position illegally as a sheriff. 4 years later, he has no longer any peace officer certification unless you let his illegal time as sheriff qualify for that. And I have a hard time with that. 4 years later then, right before he took his second term, calendar year 2004, he took his term with no valid peace officer certificate. And he's had no valid peace officer certificate since. None. So you have an uneducated person acting as sheriff, a person who went to the wrong school acting as sheriff, a person without a valid peace officer certificate, acting as sheriff of Brown County. All this time only because no one ran against him who had standing to file the writ of quo warranto. When you look at these, it seems complicated, but the details really are not. He had no educational qualification to take office in calendar year 2000. He did not go to the right school. His certificate expired 4 years later, and it's been expired ever since. And this is not depending upon anybody's affidavit, Your Honor, saying, I believe that he met the qualifications because it was close enough, and what we really meant when we were on the board was this and that, and what we really meant as legislators was this. Can you imagine if any other elected legislator came to you with an affidavit and said, this is what we really meant by that statute? Can you imagine any circumstance that you would buy that or believe that or rely upon that under any circumstances? Or if the law says this is what's required, and a legislator wrote for you an affidavit and said, but we really meant this, and this is good enough, that under any circumstances you would buy that? None. Whatsoever. And that's why I've asked you to reject the SPIVAC and the calendar affidavits and all these emails and all these unsworn letters from people. Just because you write things to people and Mr. Wenninger says, will you write this letter for me, or will you answer these questions for me, or will you give me this, and then they write a letter, or they write an email, and they put it in a public record, that's not sworn, and that's not admissible in court. No different than if I stood up here to you and I said, here's this letter someone wrote me, and I tried to get that in evidence in a trial, because that is the standard under Rule 56. If it's not admissible in a trial, it's not admissible in summary judgment. You would not let someone produce a letter from Spivak or from Calendar or from DeGarmo or an email who's not there to verify it and be cross-examined. And that's why none of that means anything. And every time he says it's unrebutted, well, it's rebutted by the law and it's rebutted by the truth. And it means nothing, and I'd ask the court to disregard it completely for all purposes. I mentioned before that you see so many of these quo warranto cases, and so many of them are sheriffs. In fact, I can't remember one that's anything other than a sheriff. It seems like sheriffs are the only ones getting into this situation, but I would suggest that it's because some people try to shortcut. Some people try to get into positions that they should not be in, and it builds and it builds and it builds, and this is what you have. Mistakes and unqualified people holding the office. And I would suggest to your honors that if you look at the quo warranto cases I've cited to you, where sheriffs have been removed from office for less errors and less mistakes and less deficiencies in their qualifications than this one here. I know it's a tough thing, and they've argued well that turning over an election is a serious thing to do. But sometimes it has to be done when the person who ran for the office is not qualified to hold it by the law. And that's all that you're confronted with, is he's not qualified. There's no fact saying he's qualified. And I'd ask him to stand up and try to say, how is 14 months 2 years? How is TTI anything close to Ohio Board of Regents accredited when it's not? And how can you say that illegally holding the office from 2000 to 2004 qualifies you to hold the office later? You can't do that. I don't know if it's unclean hands or if it's inequity or something, but you can't illegally hold an office and then claim that time in office qualifies you to continue to hold the office after that. I don't think you can do that. And unless this court does something about it now, and that's what quo warranto is for, it's just going to continue. There's never been a question that Dennis Farnow is qualified to hold the office of sheriff. No one has ever questioned it. No one has ever protested it. The Board of Elections, whatever it's worth, and he ran for the office and was the second highest vote getter. And I've cited to you the cases that means he's the only person withstanding to file the quo warranto. He's the only person entitled to the office. And he's the one who should have held the office ever since. And the writ is asking your honors to remove Mr. Wenninger from the office that he's never been qualified to have, and to instate Dennis Farnow to that office. I'm happy to answer any questions. I hope I haven't bored you. If I've not, I've probably got how many minutes?
15 seconds.
Man, I'm good. I'll save the remainder of my 5 minutes then, Your Honor.
All right.
I thank Your Honor for your time this morning.
All Rosenhoff?
I'm going to date myself. When I was a kid, there was this cartoon called Mr. Magoo. Mr. Magoo had this guy called Professor Peabody. Professor Peabody had the Wayback Machine. Now, let's keep our eye on the prize here. Paragraph 2 of the complaint for quo warranto contests what? The 2008 election. Not the 2000 election. It can only deal with the 2008 election. What Mr. Varnow wants this panel to do is become Professor Peabody, go back in some convoluted fashion and connect dots and reinvent a wheel. If you want to talk about inequity, look at the qualification statute as it existed in 2008 and please find very clearly that one, Sheriff Wininger's OPATA certificate has no expiration date. Two, he has been the Brown County Sheriff, the supervisor of the police force, for more than 3 years of supervisory experience. There's no break in service here. It's really that simple. What we've been willing to walk along here and do for a few months, actually for 2 years, is indulge Mr. Varnow's belief that somehow or another there was an educational deficiency. Many, perhaps even on this panel, loaded hours to get through college, as I did. Many on this panel may have loaded hours to get through law school quicker. The thing I couldn't load hours on was my military service. I had to serve all of that. But we're talking about academic calendars. We're not talking about calendar years, post-secondary education. If you bought the argument from Mr. Varnow, those people who got a two-year associate's degree, however they got it, from Miami Jacobs, a proprietary school, in law enforcement or criminal justice, would not be qualified to run for the office of sheriff. That has never been the intent of this statute. The intent has been to get some post-secondary education. But it's immaterial with regard to the 2008 election. And that's the important point, I think, that needs to be made. That's the only election that could be attacked. If you want to do equity, equity would be Dwayne Wininger's been there for 11 years at this point as sheriff. He met the statutory qualifications and in the 2008 election. You can't get in Professor Peabody's Wayback Machine and go back and start unraveling everything. It's been attacked and attacked and attacked. The second observation I'll make is that this is not the first time that this matter has been subject to a court's determination. One of the members of the 12th District Court of Appeals sat in a criminal trial, resolved favorably to Sheriff Wininger. So that's an inaccurate statement to say that no court has ever looked at this matter before. And therein may lay another equity. So if we're going to talk about court invoking equitable powers, which it probably has the ability to do in quo warranto, a common law based, now statutory, common law and constitutionally, but now statutorily based action. I think the last observation I have to make, and I want to consult with co-counsel before I sit down, is this court deals with the standard for summary judgment daily. There were two cases in here yesterday when I was here. You'll probably have three tomorrow. You're familiar with the standard, and as I said before, most of your law clerks can probably recite it to you. No genuine issue of fact, judgment is a matter of law. What does 56E say? Now, we'll get in a Wayback Machine. 56E says you have to meet affidavits with sworn statements, either depositions or affidavits. There is absolutely not a shred of evidence put before this court that is of the evidentiary qualification or evidentiary level of the affidavits of Spivak and Callender. Nothing. There is not a deposition
a sworn statement from anybody from the village of Ripley, former Chief Bowman, the clerk, somebody to support Mr. Varnow's position. Not a single sworn statement other than Mr. Varnow's, which simply says I'm qualified to be sheriff. And the bottom line is, going and getting that Wayback Machine, he still has no POTUS certificate that has no expiration date. He's still got the evidence of Calendar and Spivak. There have been 2.5 years to find some rebutting evidence. I can tell you that when we went searching for answers to the question in 2000, we went to the Board of Regents and found the answer. I think we can assume that there may have been a search for somebody to rebut those affidavits, and it proved unsuccessful.
Okay, that's your time, Mr. Rosenhoff.
Thank you.
Mr. Eagle.
Thank you very much. I have to agree, you can't go back in time and do anything about the previous elections. We're not asking you to. We're asking you to do something about who currently holds the office illegally. That's all we're asking you to do, and you're allowed to do that. And I know there, it is true, obviously, that people can get into office illegally if no one runs against them, if no one files a protest, if the Board of Elections don't do something, and then they can hold the office. No question about that. We can't do anything about that. Only thing you can do is when someone runs against a person who is qualified and the other person is not, to do what the law requires you to do, to take the unqualified person out. That's what we're asking you to do. He's currently has no 2 years of post-secondary education. He did not stand up here like I invited him to do and tell you how 14 months equals 2 years, 24 months. He didn't do it. He can't do it. We're not, when we go to law school, are not required to go to school for 3 years. There's no law statute that says we have to go to school for 3 years, and so we have to have a law degree from an accredited institution. Doesn't matter if it takes you 15 years. So it's not an equivalent. It's a false equivalent. He did not take office with accreditation from an Ohio Board of Regents accredited school, no matter what some friend of his wants to say. And he's had no valid service in the office of sheriff since his certificate, since he took office and since his certificate expired. Those are the simple facts. And Rule 56E does not say affidavits or deposition. It also says pleadings and other admissible evidence. Look at the case law. It says what it is. If it's admissible in trial, it's admissible in summary judgment. All of ours is. Theirs is not. You would not let Spivak and Calendar do that testimony in a court of law. Every one of you have had trial court experience. You would object to it if they tried it, and properly so. So you can't consider it here. He wants to bring up the result of his criminal trial. Read State versus Weninger. It's a reported case. Rule 29 motion was overruled because there was sufficient evidence to proceed against Mr. Weninger on charges of knowingly falsifying his election credentials. Knowingly falsifying his election credentials is different than not having the election credentials. Being found not guilty by beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury, I've already cited the cases, means nothing in the civil context whatsoever. Nothing whatsoever. All we're asking you to do is take a person who is not qualified under the law and say so, get him out of there and get someone who qualified in. And that's what law enforcement is. That's what we're asking you to do. I'm open for any questions your honors may have.
Any questions?
I probably have 15 seconds left. I'll waive it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. We will take this matter under advisement and render a ruling. There is a couple other housekeeping measures I'd like to go over with council, since this is the first opportunity that we've had to conduct a hearing and to review the pleadings up to this point. First of all, I want to remind council of the court's prior order in May 19th with regards to discovery and the evidence, and that cutoff date was June 1st, 2010. This court is going to abide by its previous order, and just so that the parties are aware that that is in place with regards to the exhibits that have been filed within the last week, the court will allow those to come in because that is not new evidence. It's only conforming evidence that the council believes is necessary in order for this court to make a ruling on the Civil Rule 56 motion for summary judgment. Now, with that being said, we have not in any way made any decision at all with regards to your respective motions. I am going to just lay out just a roadmap just so we're on the same page of what will transpire in the event that this court denies both motions for summary judgment. According to our local appellate rule 20, we set forth the procedures for original actions that are filed in this court. And in that, we have, according to 20G, the evidence in all original actions except habeas corpus shall be submitted to the court by means of an agreed statement of facts or stipulations or depositions. Oral testimony will not be heard unless the consent of the court is otherwise obtained. At this point, this is the direction that I am giving both parties here, that that will be the next step. The briefs that would be due are set forth in a timeline under subdivision H, and I would anticipate that that time frame will be set forth in a scheduling order in the event that both the motions are denied. That decision will contain a scheduling order for times of brief, and then we'll set the matter for our arguments at a later date. Is there any questions of counsel as to the procedure that you can expect on the original action?
Not on behalf of Sheriff Winter.
If I understand Your Honor's correctly, indicating that if in fact you overrule both motions, the matter will obviously be set for trial, just like in any other trial court. It will be conducted pursuant to Rule 20, including briefing oral argument. That's what you were telling us.
That is the evidence that would be submitted to. It's somewhat different, and you're actually going to call witnesses to the stand. It's going to be more of kind of an appellate argument based upon the evidence admitted, why you should be successful on the merits of the case.
What you were saying is trial procedure if you overrule both motions. Thank you very much.
And one last thing, just to make sure, I've covered the exhibits, and this is here on motions, respective motions for summary judgment and motions to strike opposing parties' evidence. Is there any other motions before this court that is still pending and has not been addressed?
Not that I think of, not that it would not be moved at this point.
All right.
It just sticks in the back of my mind, and I only went back to January.
Of what year?
Of this year, getting ready for this. But it seems to me that there was some other motion that Mr. Varnett had filed historically that had never been ruled upon. And I forget whether it's a motion to strike, or a motion to, because we're going back to, I want to say, August. I know Mr. Eagle withdrew one, which was a motion to compel. But I think there was one other hanging out there from back there that he had some evidentiary issues. And this would go back to August, September, October of 2009. Here's what I'll do. If I find it, I'll fax to everybody.
I've gone through the docket, and I can pretty much tell you right now what realtor has filed in that time frame, and we'll just start. The first was the complaint in February. Then April 3rd of 09, realtor's motion for discovery and presentation of evidence. Then August 10th of 09 was realtor's motion for summary judgment, and then they attached the exhibits. And then I have October 14th, realtor's reply to respondent's memo in opposition. April 13th, 2010, the realtor's notice of submission and request for oral argument. And then May 17th, realtor's motion to modify entry granting final opportunity. And then there's August 20th, 2010, realtor's motion to vacate judgment. And that was before, I think, it went up to the Supreme Court, and then it came back. And then from there, we have a motion, or realtor's withdrawal motion to vacate. and then his request, relator's request for oral argument in March of this year, and renewed objections and motions to strike and admissible evidence.
These are probably the one about vacating the judgment, and I don't know.
Okay. They withdrew that after came back.
That would have been the one, because that's okay. The time frame I'm talking about.
Okay.
Something back there that I didn't remember why.
Well, appreciate the presentation that both parties have given us and given us direction as we proceed. Thank you.